If we could please come to order, we've a quorum of the Labor and Consumer Protection Division. We've got a number of bills on the agenda today. It looks like we're kind of covering the waterfront of this committee, everything from unemployment to foreclosure to cocoa beans. Representative Hornstein, cocoa beans, sir. Welcome to the committee. The chair moves that House File 1306 be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, just a note for everyone on legislative procedure and decorum. We do ask that, and I appreciate people's responsiveness to the request that there be no signs in the hearing room. Tradition and decorum and rule around the legislature is that people are expected to be respectful of everyone in the process. We don't cheer, we don't boo, we do like to laugh. But other than that, appreciate people being respectful of the process, and we will work as expeditiously as we can. People would be respectful. If you have conversations, please take them out in the hall so that the committee can deliberate appropriately. President Hornstein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I miss this committee. I was served on it last year, and it's good to be back.
I'm sorry, Representative Hornstein, let me make sure I did this before.
Okay.
I'd like to move that House File 1306 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We got it done.
There is an A090199 amendment that
needs
to incorporate as well.
And this is your amendment, Representative Hornstein?
Yes, getting it in the form I'd like the bill to be presented in.
All right, then the Chair would move the A090199 amendment to be before the committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So your bill is amended, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members, you're probably wondering the same thing I did when this first was brought to my attention. Well, why is there an issue with cocoa bean shell mulch? Well, I have a constituent, and he is going to testify about it, and he is by no means the only one that is concerned about this. This has a very toxic chemical in it, theobromine. That's why we're here before the Consumer Division, and this has had some very negative impacts on animals and pets when they come into contact with it. And I will just defer to Mr. Terry Hall, who lives in Southwest Minneapolis, had an experience with this, and he'll tell you the story about why we're here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Mr. Hall, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Hall. I'm here on behalf of not just my family, but my neighbors and other constituents that live in Southwest Minneapolis. I'm also here as a former military working dog handler with the United States Air Force. So not only do I have an affection for pets, but I've also seen their valuable use and service to our country during my time with the military. I'm here to bring attention to this committee and to everyone else who will listen about the toxic effects of cocoa bean mulch. On July 4th weekend of 2007, a beautiful Minnesota day, my wife and I were out on the St. Croix River playing with our dog Moose, who I'd love to pass some photographs around so you can get some type of context of who we're talking about. And the only indication that we had that anything was something wrong with our dog was when we called him and he did not come back right away. While we were on the St. Croix, my wife was just playing frisbee with him, and threw the frisbee, he went after it, and suddenly collapsed and fell underneath the water. At that time, I jumped in, grabbed Moose, and began canine CPR, as well as calling 911 to try to get any further assistance. Now, to put this in perspective, if this dog had a chance with anyone, it was with me based upon my military training. And to also put in perspective, we had just gone to the vet 3 days prior and had a total clean bill of health on the three-year-old chocolate lab. Now, I had the unfortunate experience of telling my wife that her very first pet and the very first gift I had ever given her as my wife died right there in front of her. And upon Moose's death, we took him to the University of Minnesota to have a necropsy done, which is the equivalent of a canine autopsy. And we found that he had ingested cocoa bean mulch. Well, to add insult to injury, I personally was the one who had put that cocoa bean mulch down in my yard just the day before, while family were coming to visit us for the first time in Minnesota. We immediately went home, we grabbed the bag, we looked at the bag, it said pesticide-free, organic. All the words that would lead any consumer to believe that this is a healthy, vibrant product to be putting in your yard. Upon further research, we found that the cocoa bean mulch, and based upon the necropsy from the University of Minnesota, contains a chemical called theobromine. Now, the only way I know to put this in perspective for you is like this. It would be equivalent to me giving you speed and asking you to run Grandma's marathon. Nobody would really know anything was wrong with you until your heart just exploded and you died on the side of the street. The same indications that happened, or the same situation that happened with Moose. We then contacted the mulch company, to no avail. We were basically brushed to the side, that they would look into it. And so then we sought other avenues to bring awareness about this issue. We consulted an attorney to try to bring this into litigation. However, this was the national case of almost pet consumer recognition, if you will, of products out there for pet owners to buy. My wife and I did not have the means to fund that legal crusade, so we turned to the media, of which we became a national story on ABC on the nightly desk. And then we turned to the people that we need the most, which are all of you, to say, please, let's bring some type of awareness about this particular chemical that's in this mulch and prevent this from happening in the future. Ironically enough, in Southwest Minneapolis, my wife and I, who walk the streets of Southwest Minneapolis almost daily, talked with 30 or 40 of our neighbors who have cocoa bean mulch out in their yard and had no idea that this particular product caused this type of damage. The ironic thing about all of this is that it can be prevented. These companies can process the cocoa beans further so that it strips the theobromine from those chemicals. But some of them don't choose to do that. So those that don't choose to do that, they just dump this out on the open market. And we're talking about huge companies like Hershey, you know, that's probably one of the biggest sellers of this cocoa bean mulch. So you could imagine a lonely citizen like myself trying to take on Hershey's chocolate. That would be a pretty tall order. And so we're asking you to please help bring awareness by merely having people who distribute this product label it accordingly, so that consumers can be aware that if they buy this product and they put it out in their yard, it can potentially cause these types of problems.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Hall. Dr. Murphy, please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony, sir.
Sure. My name is Mike Murphy. I'm a veterinary toxicologist at the U of M. I've been there about 22 years. My appointment is split partly with the veterinary diagnostic lab to which the dog went for the necropsy, and partly with the college teaching veterinary students and whatnot. I just have a few brief comments and then mostly would serve as someone to respond to questions as
Thanks,
far
sir.
As. The concentration of theobromine, the toxin mentioned already, or chemical mentioned already, may vary substantially in the mulch depending on how the mulch is processed. If the mulch contains about a residue of about 1% theobromine, then a 55-pound dog or so about the size of this one would need to eat about 9 ounces of the mulch, which is represented by these two Ziploc bags of mulch, if you will, or about 8 ounces of baking chocolate or baking cocoa, if represented by this box, if it's the baking chocolate contains the publicly stated amount of theobromine in it. So I just have that as a kind of a visual aid on how much the dog would need to eat. Just as we know that milk chocolate is much less toxic than baking cocoa because of the theobromine content, the more highly processed mulch would be substantially less toxic than the less processed mulch, which is my understanding of the reason for the amendment to the bill that you have before you now, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct. That's correct.
And with that, I turn it back over.
All right. Representative Horn.
I have just 30 seconds of additional testimony from Mr. Goldman, who is with the Animal Humane Society.
Mr. Goldman, if you're in the... Oh, you're standing right there. Mr. Goldman, welcome to the committee. If someone could thank Mr. Hall. And Mr. Goldman, as you've seen, if you'd introduce yourself to the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Howard Goldman. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Humane Society of the United States, Animal Protectionist Organization. We have 180,000 members in the state of Minnesota, and we fully support this legislation. We think it's important, and we think that it'll make a significant difference. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I conclude our testimony on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Any questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience wanting to testify either for or against House File 1306? Representative Hornstein, you hit the chair's sweet spot. I was raised with labs, and my parents' last dog was a chocolate named Brooke. My father would, in fact, feed it M&Ms until he learned that's not the thing you do. Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's very straightforward. I think this will protect our canine and other animal communities here, and simple, straightforward consumer protection measure, and I seek your support.
I appreciate that, Representative Hornstein. With that, members, the chair renews his motion that House File 1306 is amended, recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Testifiers.
Thank you very much.
All right. Representative Carlson. We're going to jump around. Thank you to Representative Nelson for his willingness to allow Representative Carlson to come forward at this time. Welcome to the committee, Representative Carlson. I'll move that House File 1671 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. I understand there's an office amendment, sir?
Yes, and it, Mr. Chairman, should be distributed. We emailed it to you yesterday.
All right. Members, in your packet, you should find the AO90172 author's amendment. As it is an author's amendment, I will move that amendment at this time. Any all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Representative Carlson, do your bill as amended, sir?
Mr. Chairman, this bill deals with labor management relations and is brought forward by the IFO, that's the Interfaculty Organization. They would represent the state university system. But it also has, in part, an impact on community colleges as well, and it's my understanding both unions would be supportive of the bill. The first section of the bill requires an agency has to do payroll deduction of union dues or fair share for both unions when an employee belongs to two bargaining units. And what has happened is that more and more faculty are hired to work part-time at a community college and part-time at a state university, and currently the union dues can only be deducted for one of those two entities. And so if you were working equal time, in my example here, you would have half your union dues perhaps deducted for the community college union, and you would have to write a check to the IFO for the other half your dues, or whatever that proration happens to be. So what this would do is allow for that dues checkoff to take place for both entities, and would simplify the process. Section 2 changes the amount of work an outside professional or technical contractor can perform without becoming part of the bargaining unit and covered by the collective bargaining contract. And this one here is to bring about a change. Currently,
The law references two consecutive quarters, and a number of years ago, I think about 10 years ago, we went with a semester system. So I view this section as an update reflecting that we're now under a semester system and not a quarter system in our public higher education systems in Minnesota. Section 2, Clause K, counts teaching service during the entire year for determining whether a part-time faculty member exceeds the 3-credit threshold that would make them a member of the bargaining unit. And this would, for example, bring summer school, summer classes into to the equation. Section 3 does the same thing for Section 1, except those of you that are familiar with the collective bargaining laws in Minnesota know that there's also people who choose not to join the bargaining unit pay what we call a fair share. And so this would cover the checkoffs for union dues for fair share people being able to have it deducted by both a community college contractor employment and the state universities as well. And I do have with me representatives of the IFO who, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like them to be available for questions or if you'd like them to make a quick comment, I'll leave that up to you.
What is your preference or theirs, Representative Carlson?
Would you like to make a quick comment?
I can make a quick comment.
Sure. Yeah. So if you'd please introduce yourself to the tape and then proceed with your brief comments.
Sure. For the record, my name is Rod Henry, president of the Interfaculty Organization representing the university faculty in Minsky. And just to add to what the Representative Carlson has said, basically what we're doing is we're just bringing the law up to speed with the effects of the merger, particularly changes that have occurred in our last contract over the last few years. Traditionally, we had fall, spring, and then summer school sessions. Well, now we have intersessions. Now we have, so we have sessions in between the fall and the spring semester, things that occur at the end of spring. We also are moving to 9-month flexible appointments so that faculty members can be starting their appointments at different times during the year. And again, this will enable us to more efficiently deal with those faculty members.
Very good. You've got another individual there at the desk. Are you wishing to testify as well, ma'am?
My name is Connie Howard. I'm the general counsel. I'm here basically to answer any questions.
You've got our back. Thank you. Questions from the members for Representative Carlson or Mr. Henry? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 1671? Sir, please come to the table, introduce yourself to the tape, and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, my name is Chris Dale. I'm with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I'm only really here to address Section 1, Subdivision 1, with respect to House File 1671. At this time, Section 3 as well, the provision that would modify PELRA. At this time, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities would like to defer action on this part of the file, because we are concerned that the dual dues deductions will, by expanding the number of employees subject to automatic deductions, actually expands an area of potential liability should we be sued by employees for dues deductions. We have concerns, and the potential liability comes from two sources. One is we have concerns right now with the Bureau of Mediation Services regulations setting forth the content of what we call the Hudson Notice. And the reason we now call it a Hudson Notice is that the United States Supreme Court authorized automatic dues deductions for employees to avoid what's sometimes called the free rider problem, but recognize in doing so that automatic dues deductions are an imposition on the First Amendment rights of employees, but they nonetheless authorize that deduction. So the source of our problem is twofold. There's a kind of a line of cases from the Hudson decision that state what should be in the what must be in the Hudson notice, and our current BMS regulations don't reflect that what the developments in that line of cases, and we're concerned that that employees aren't getting the notice that's required by the Hudson line of cases. And secondly, No court that we're aware of has actually ever addressed the other problem, which is the employees we're talking about here aren't free riders in any traditional sense of the word, because they're already paying dues. They're already having dues deducted, either membership dues or the agency fee, to a different union. And it may be that they're part-time employees with a different union, but it also may be that they're full-time employees. We know that there are professional employees who pick up and teach a couple of adjunct courses from time to time. There are other employee groups that pick up classes and teach them, and those employees are already subject to a deduction. And so those are the two sources of friction with respect to this. And it isn't, we don't want to see anybody denied, any union denied its appropriate due. On the other hand, we don't wish to be exposed to this potential liability. There are a number of cases where, and it seems to be becoming more popular, where employees who are subject to an agency fee deduction are suing their employer, public employers, and there are even cases where the Tenth Circuit, for example, has said that the indemnification agreement that we have in our contract with the IFO, for example, isn't enforceable. It's voided as against the public policy, because what you're indemnifying against is the employer's constitutional violation, if there is one. It isn't clear, but we think it would be nice to have that straightened out with respect to the BMS rate.
Mr. Henry, thank you. Ms. Howard.
To respond to a couple of points, Minsky's argument seems to be that they do not like the current configuration of the fair share regulations. That's something that they can and perhaps should address through those fair share regulations. What the committee members need to understand is that the law currently requires fair share folks to pay, and that it provides for the automatic payroll deduction of those fair share fees. What we're talking about is those folks who happen to work for, in essence, two units by the same employer. And what's happening is one union is getting their dues, is getting the fair share fees or the dues, the other union is not. And where he's saying they're not free riders, that's not true. We have an obligation to represent these folks regardless of whether they are in another union, and we're not getting the fees that are associated with that. So, for example, for this year, we have about 89 people who we would otherwise be able to collect through the payroll deduction, but because they are not deducting, we don't have those resources, yet we have the obligation to represent those individuals.
Thank you, Ms. Howard. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Howard. So in a situation like that, you have the liability then, if you're not getting paid and you don't represent them, you have the liability of getting sued for non-representation. Am I correct?
Ms. Howard.
Yes, of course, although we will represent them even if we're not getting the dues at this point. We're just trying to make sure that they're paying their fair share, because if they're not, then in essence other people are having to make up for the difference for what they're not paying. And in terms of it being fair because they're paying elsewhere, both the community faculty union and the IFO have prorated dues. So if you are employed as an adjunct, you're paying a substantially lower rate than you would if you were full-time. It's like belonging to the Elks and the Lions. It's two separate organizations that provide two separate services to them, and they owe to both.
Representative Nelson.
So in effect, then, if they're not paying you, then they are free riders, and when you would have to go and represent them, so they would be free riders for you, for one group or the other, one union or the other.
Yes.
Ms. Howard. Any other questions or comments? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on House File 1671, either for or against? Representative Carlson, any closing comments?
I think the committee has got a good understanding of what the issues are, and I would appreciate positive action on your motion.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, Chair Renews' motion that House File 1671, as amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Carlson. Thank you to the testifiers.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson. Mm-hmm.
people are folding and unfolding papers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Nelson?
Yeah, I'd like to move my bill. I recommend House File 1767 and recommend it to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Representative Nelson, I understand there's the H-1767A1 amendment. Is that yours, sir?
Yes, it is. And I'd like to put that motion, I'd like to make a motion to add that amendment on to put it in the order that I want the bill.
All right. With that, members of the A1 amendment is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, to your bill as amended, sir.
Grab my testimony here. As you know, last year, or 2 years ago, we passed legislation dealing with independent contractors and who are sole proprietors in the construction industry. With this bill, it's got broad bipartisan support and support of the Department of Labor and Industry, and it was trying to get at misclassified workers who are working off the books, weren't being covered by workers' compensation, unemployment, and to bring them into the fold. The law came into full effect this January 1, and we had a little, you know, had a lot of positive effects for the industry, but it had some unexpected problems that came up. For instance, right now, under the current law, if you're an independent contractor and you file as an S-Corp or a limited liability corporation, you don't have to file as an independent contractor. And so they're not being able, the Department of Labor and Industry is not being able to track these people and get at, find out whether they are complying with the law, whether they do, are paying their proper taxes, whether they're covered by workers' compensation. And so this is what this bill is getting after. In your packet, there's a handout from the Secretary of State's office that shows a list of new LLCs that were filed in January and February, from February to December. And it shows the ones that are circled in red are all ones that are construction companies. And the Department of Labor and Industry doesn't have this information. They don't have a way to get at these people or find out if people are complying. So what we're trying to do here is get a registration of these people to register with the Department of Labor and Industry. Then the Department of Labor and Industry will be able to track them. That's what House File 1767 does. Now, this bill has been developed with consultation with the Department of Labor and Industry, with management representatives, being supported by the Carpenters Union, by the Association of General Contractors in Minnesota, the Minnesota Mechanical and Contractors Association, the Carpentry Contractors Association, the Drywall and Plasters Association, the Minnesota Environmental Contractors Association, the Minnesota Floor Covers Association, the Painting Wall Cover Employers Association, the Thermal Insulation Contractors Association, and we have bipartisan support of the bill. And I also have Deb Junroot here, that's from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and she sent me an email that this goes after some of the things that came out of their report last year about registration, and I'd like to have her come down and give some comments.
Ms. Junroot, if you please come down. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Deb Janad. You're all the clerk.
Pardon me.
Deb Janad with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I am a project manager in the Program Evaluation Division, and we've done some work over the last 3 years that relate to this issue. We did not do any work specific to this bill. In particular, we didn't analyze any cost or burden issues for unlicensed contractors. But that said, this reporting requirement would support OLA findings from several reports. Lack of tax compliance among the self-employed contributes significantly to Minnesota's tax gap, and this bill would create another electronic trail to help improve tax compliance in Minnesota. As Representative Nelson said, misclassification of employees as independent contractors is an important issue. We issued a report in 2007 and pointing out how important it is for independent contractors to be clearly independent contractors and not employees. And one of the issues is, how do we identify, you know, possible misclassification? How do we identify those who are legitimately acting as independent contractors or sole proprietors? So again, this bill would create an electronic trail that it would allow better enforcement of and determinations in misclassification cases. And finally, just a month or so ago, we issued a report on workers' compensation. One of our recommendations there was that the Department of Labor and Industry needs to improve its efforts to identify employers who are not providing workers' compensation when they should. And again, this this bill would provide a tool for them to be able to do so.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, you have another testifier with you?
He's just here to answer, help answer questions.
All right. Members, any questions on House File 1767? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 1767? Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a template, like I said, to help the Department of Labor and Industry to track these people. It's not, you know, there's nothing wrong with being an LLC. There's nothing wrong with being an independent contractor. In fact, it's encouraged, it's good for business, but we want to make sure that we have a way to get to track these people to make sure that they are complying with the laws, and if they are employing people, that they are covered by workers' compensation, so when they're injured, they can be taken care of, they are covered by unemployment, and that the people are paying properly into those funds.
Thank you. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 1767 is amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to wait for Representative Mullery. Pages are out finding him. And so chat quietly amongst yourselves for a minute. That was a short minute. That was a Mullery. Timing is everything. Thank you, sir. Representative Nelson, would you like to move House File 19?
Yes, I'll move House File 19 to be recommended to pass and move to Commerce and Labor.
That would be correct. Representative Mullery, I have in the packets an A1 amendment. Is that your amendment, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Representative Nelson, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
I'll move the A1 amendment also, sir.
All right. All those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Mullery, welcome to the committee. See, your bill is amended.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for getting it on, despite some hang-ups someplace in the system of hearing requests.
It wouldn't be the legislature without some hang-ups somewhere along the line.
I found out about the certain member here having a CA that didn't put on their own bills in their own committee. So, it happened. And, Mr. Chairman, I was just discussing it with one of the representatives of the lenders, the A1 amendment, to explain that it actually came from the bill was written by the lobbyist for the real property section of the Bar Association, and this amendment was also written by him to clarify a part of it. This bill actually is one that helps both sides in this. What happens often is you have maybe 4 to 5 months from the time of default until the sheriff's sale, and during that period on a foreclosure, you can pay up the arrears, and that's obviously much easier to do than pay off the entire mortgage debt. You may have a few thousand dollars versus $200,000. Once the sheriff's sale occurs, you have to pay off the entire thing during the redemption period in order to save the property, and unless you have a rich uncle that dies or something, you're not going to be able to do that normally. So without interfering with the times that the lenders would get the property back in the long run, this bill helps mortgagors, and that it does that by putting off the sheriff sale. So that if you're out of work or you're sick for maybe 3 months or something like that, you have some time to catch up, gather some money, and reinstate before the sheriff's sale so that you don't have to pay off the entire mortgage to keep your house. And that's what this bill does. And of course, the reason that the lenders want is they've got stockpiles of houses all over they don't know what to do with. They don't want the house back. They want the, a good lender wants the loan paid off. That's why they made the loan, was to get their investment back on the loan through the payments. And so basically this is a win-win for both sides of it. And all it does, the bill just puts off for 5 months of the 6 months, it puts off the sheriff sale at the request of the mortgagor, and then reduces the redemption period to 5 weeks in return, so that it doesn't harm the overall time for the lender to get the property back. And that's what this amendment does, is just to clarify that it has the 5 months extension, and then the Bar Association asked that we make the redemption period 5 weeks to coincide with the 5 weeks that are the that is the redemption period on abandoned property, and which we put in several years ago. And then the other part of this exemption just takes care of, once in a while somebody will file a bankruptcy and the automatic stay requires a restart. And if we didn't have this exemption, or I mean this amendment, then there would be a problem in that on the second time for the foreclosure, the Bar Association thinks that there'd be a 6 month redemption period. So instead of the overall staying roughly 6 months, then they could get the 5 months and then file a bankruptcy and get another 6 months. And that was not my intent. My intent is to try to keep the period the same so that we're not interfering with the lenders getting property back, and at the same time give a huge benefit to the mortgagor, so that we're not really taking advantage of either party on this. And that's why I think everybody I've talked to agrees with this.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify either for or against House File 19? Boy, that's a rare moment. Any questions for members?
This is a true peace in the valley, a win-win situation.
and
around here.
And good assistance for folks facing foreclosure. Representative Mahoney.
How did you manage to carry something like that?
You don't have to answer.
Please. Any closing words?
Mr. Chairman, I just think the bill speaks for itself. It was a wonderful idea by the author and perfected by the Bar Association in writing an excellent bill. And I'm glad that I was able to work with the lenders from the beginning. And they, once they looked into it, they saw that it was a positive for them too. So
very good. All right. With that, the chair, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 19 is amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. On your way, Representative Mullering.
Thank you,
Mr. To members into the audience, we are awaiting a possible amendment to Representative Bly's bill. There may be some delay in that, and so at this point we'll recess until the call of the chair.
Not until I get done passing out the cookies.
Stick around long enough for the cookies.
To the 5-year lifetime limit, and more of us are having to go to food shelves or finding ourselves with no housing. So what we need is a bailout for the people, and this legislation is a people's bailout bill that addresses many of the issues that people in this state are facing. And it takes really crucial steps to protect low-income and working Minnesotans. It addresses, I'm just doing a very brief overview of the main points. The bill addresses three main areas. The first one is jobs or income now.
It extends unemployment benefits and makes more people eligible for unemployment insurance, although as you heard, that is not going to be moving in this bill right now. Creates a public works program that provides grants to cities and towns to put people to work now. And it provides a two-year extension to the five-year lifetime limit on public assistance, which is the unemployment program for poor families who often won't qualify for unemployment insurance. So whether it's unemployment benefits or public assistance in this time of crisis, job layoffs and rising unemployment, there's definitely a need for income support to get us through this time. The second main area is housing. This bill puts a moratorium on foreclosures for homeowners and allows tenants to keep their leases if their landlords go into foreclosure, thus preventing tenants from becoming homeless. The third area is layoffs. The bill states that in order to protect jobs and prevent increasing unemployment, the legislature must not mandate layoffs of State and U of M workers. Now, a lot of focus, as we know, has been at the legislature, has been on the state deficit that we're in. And unfortunately, much of the talk is about cutting even more services and programs for the same people who are suffering from the most from the economic downturn. This is the time to be helping people in this state instead of cutting what we need. And this bill will take huge steps to help Minnesotans in this time of crisis. So we urge you to support the People's Bailout Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Konechny. Next on my list is Phyllis Walker. Ms. Walker in the... Sure enough. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Phyllis Walker, president of ASME Local 3800, the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Working class people in Minnesota are currently in the grip of a huge economic crisis. We all know that. It's an economic crisis that threatens our jobs, it threatens our homes, and it threatens everything we have struggled to build for ourselves and our families. The way the economic crisis has been dealt with so far hasn't worked. The money that was funneled to the banking industry has not and will not trickle down to working class people. As the unemployment rate continues to climb and the economy worsens, it becomes more and more evident that working class people need a bailout of their own. More and more people tell me how desperate their lives have become. Last week, a clerical worker at the U told me about her situation. She was laid off from her second job and doesn't know how she's going to pay her mortgage and take care of her family on the meager wages she earns at her first job at the University of Minnesota. Needless to say, she's terrified when she hears of possible layoffs at the U. A person I spoke with a few weeks ago told me the trucking company where her husband worked for many years downsized and he lost his job. They want to sell their home instead of losing it to foreclosure, but so few people are in the market to buy homes that it's doubtful that they'll find a buyer. The moratorium on foreclosures would indeed help this couple. One last example, I told a friend of mine who's about to run out of unemployment benefits about the People's Bailout Bill. When I told her the bill would be introduced today, she told me she's guardedly optimistic about her chances to stay afloat as she continues to look for another job. She told me to tell you that an extension of her unemployment benefits might just be the bridge that she needs to keep her from losing her apartment and her meager savings. An extension of unemployment benefits would indeed help my friend. Our bill would help not only the people I just mentioned, it would help all Minnesotans. Because when we help the people most in need, it impacts workers at all levels. Working class people ultimately need living wage jobs that only government can create, and until those jobs are created, working class people need the safety net of the People's Bailout Bill. The People's Bailout Bill has been endorsed by ASME Council 5 that represents 40,000 workers in the state, the St. Paul Regional Labor Federation that represents 45,000 workers in the state. It's currently being considered by the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and we're very confident they will endorse it. And ASME Local 3800, my union, is an active member of the Minnesota Coalition for People's Bailouts. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thanks, President Walker. Next on the list is Bernie Hess, United Food and Commercial Workers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Local 789, Food and Commercial Workers Union, supports this bill. I'd like to thank Representative Bly. We represent workers in three sectors, retail, long-term care, and food processing. We have layoffs in retail for the first time in 26 years. I got laid off 26 years ago, and during the right now this is the first time in quite a while. Long-term care workers, their hours are being reduced, and in food processing, we're looking at reduction in hours in packing plants and possible closure. We need a net. Workers are taking loans out of their 401 accounts to cover. These are desperate times, and we appreciate the efforts, and we'd ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Peter Nikitas. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nikitas. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members of the legislature. I'm Peter Nikitas. I'm a private lawyer in practice in Minneapolis. I live in St. Louis Park. I'm here as a lawyer and citizen advocating in favor of this people's bailout. This morning I woke up and found on my my computer an article by a former Assistant Treasury Secretary under President Ronald Reagan named Paul Craig Roberts. He asks, was the bailout itself a scam? He is certainly referring to the bailouts of the massive banks and insurance companies that ensued in October of 2008 and have continued into the present administration. He asks, were these bailouts necessary, or were they a scam, like weapons of mass destruction used to advance a private agenda behind a wall of fear? These, of course, were bailouts that helped a handful of corporations, large banks and large financial concerns like AIG. The bill before you is a people's bailout. The bill before you is something that the legislature has already dealt with in the 1930s. Chapter 339 of the laws of Minnesota. And the same issues were raised then and are being raised now. What is the sanctity of contracts? We can't impair their obligations. The legislature answered that affirmatively by saying that it wasn't just about contracts for private and personal interests. It's about the good of the community and the moral uplifting of the entire community, that we recognize that the facts on the ground show an emergency right now affecting the entire community, from the humblest people to those on the top, and the legislature has the power and the moral obligation to do something about it. Mortgagees challenged the bill that the legislature passed and Governor Olson signed in the 30s. It went all the way to the United States Supreme Court after the Supreme Court of the state of Minnesota upheld the legislation as the necessary police power legislation that did not impair the obligations of contracts, but just by putting a temporary change to the remedies without extinguishing the rights under contract. The Supreme Court of the United States upheld that great act of the legislature in the case of Home Building and Loan Association against Blaisdell. That's reported at 290 U.S. 398. And I see the chair does seem to have some passing familiarity more of about that case, and that's great.
Mr.
taught us that in law school, but I'm saying this. That the people's bailout addresses a situation whose facts on the ground are as distressing, if not more so, than 75 years ago. More people have mortgages, their mortgages are longer, and more people who are renting are at the mercy of people, of landlords, whose houses are being foreclosed on. This bill addresses that problem with a temporary solution. It does not extinguish rights that people have under contract, but it is a proper and a moral exercise of the legislature's power to look out for the good of the entire community. What we're measured on is not how we lift up a handful to the uppermost height, but rather what do we do to uplift most of us in the times of great distress, because our great laws are not extinguished or modified during emergencies. Torah is always valid. The Constitution is always valid. And I see by Representative Simon's face that, yes, Torah says don't even take away somebody's cloak so they can sleep in at night if they owe you money. Don't take away their millstone if they need to make a living in order to pay back their debt. This bill does what the Bible and what the great legislatures in the 30s did. To create a temporary modification of remedies, no extinguishment of contractual rights, but it's what we need to get through this crisis that nobody here really had a hand in creating, but we all have a hand in solving, at least in our state. And for those reasons, Representative Dabney and esteemed members of the legislature, I urge its passage as it has been presented. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nikitas. You are reviewing history near and dear to this chair's heart. Ms. Rosemary Williams from the Minnesota Tenants Union. Well, you folks are nice and orderly up there behind. Oh, I didn't know.
We're organized.
You, I shouldn't be surprised. Ms. Williams, welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I sit before you as a woman who has went through foreclosure. I am to be evicted March 30th from my property where we have lived for 55 years. I have two grandchildren and my son that live with me also. Went through unemployment, lost my property, the bottom line. You know, you don't have jobs, you can't pay these mortgages. I recently became employed, called TCF and asked them about the bailout money, and they told me that they were going to give the money back because their portfolio was good. And, you know, I just questioned, how can you give back money in the state of Minnesota when you have all these people going through foreclosure? I don't understand that. The shelters are full. People are living in the streets. People are having to leave the state of Minnesota because they can't afford the housing. They have no place to go and no money. I don't know. As a citizen of the state of Minnesota all my life, I just hope that you gentlemen and women that are representing us can look into your hearts in terms of humility, humanity, in your prayers, and do the right thing by the people of the state of Minnesota, because it not only affects people like me and other people in this room, but it affects us all. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Ms. Williams. Next on the list, I have Virginia Weldon and Lyndon, is it Gaboy? Gaboy? I'm not sure how to go there. Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Sarah Martin from WAM. Nope. Okay, we're getting down the list. That's good. That's good. Tracy Mullen from the SDF?
Nope.
All right. I did receive a note from Professor Allen. Professor Allen. And do you have handouts for the committee? I understand you have some striking visuals for us.
They're being printed.
They're being printed. Okay. They're maps that I believe I at least am familiar with in terms of the geographic distribution of foreclosures.
That's correct.
If Professor Allen, please state your name for the tape and proceed. If in the time before we adjourn, those copies do not come to the committee, we will have them distributed to committee members afterwards.
Thank you.
Professor Allen.
My name is Ryan Allen. I'm an assistant professor at the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs here at the University of Minnesota. Before I begin my testimony, let me just say that my views reflect my research expertise and don't necessarily reflect the views of the University of Minnesota. I've recently conducted research that paints a stark portrait of the race and nativity status of households that experienced foreclosure in the city of Minneapolis during fiscal years 2006 and 2007. My original sample included 5,400 housing units that experienced a foreclosure during this time period. I eventually learned household characteristics for over 2,000 of these foreclosed housing units. Four important research findings emerged from the results of this study. First, about 60% of foreclosures that occurred in Minneapolis between these fiscal years involved households living in rental properties that went into foreclosure. It is likely that renter households were disproportionately represented among households experiencing a foreclosure by a factor of nearly 2.7. A child enrolled in the Minneapolis public school system was present in almost 40% of households that lived in a foreclosed property during these fiscal years. Households with children enrolled in Minneapolis public schools were disproportionately represented among these foreclosed housing units by a factor of nearly 2.5. Finding number three, African American and Hispanic households were disproportionately represented among the sample of foreclosures that I analyzed. Over 60% of the households that experienced a foreclosure were African American, and nearly 20% were Hispanic. Finding number four, homeowner immigrant households were overrepresented among the sample of foreclosures that I analyzed. In contrast, the majority of native born households that experienced a foreclosure rented the dwelling. Of particular note is the high number of Spanish-speaking immigrant homeowner households that experience the foreclosure. Primarily because of the high geographic and racial concentration of foreclosures in Minneapolis, I believe that this crisis will hinder portions of the city population for years to come. The city's African-American, Hispanic, and immigrant populations will experience many costs related to this crisis, including economic, social, psychological, and cultural costs. In addition to these individual and household costs, existing research also indicates that entire neighborhoods experience declines in property values related to foreclosures. These declines can be particularly acute when foreclosures are numerous and highly concentrated in a few neighborhoods, conditions that accurately describe the situation in Minneapolis. Finally, the cost for cities should not be underestimated. In addition to declines in property taxes, cities usually incur costs related to maintaining abandoned housing and increased crime that are related to foreclosures. In short, and I'll conclude here, these findings suggest that it would be eminently wise for the state to take immediate action to curtail the foreclosure crisis in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Professor Allen, a quick question. When you look at the impact of the foreclosure crisis on Latino families, on Latino immigrant families, is that primarily as homesteaded property owner-occupiers or owner-occupants, or is that as more likely as tenants? What's the distribution there?
Right. It's actually more likely as homeowner. My findings were for homeowners who went through a foreclosure in the city of Minneapolis during that time period, those who were foreign-born, 80% were Hispanic, spoke the language Spanish in their household. It's clearly a very serious problem.
Thank you very much. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us a little bit more of why, like the next steps, when we talked about demographics and stuff, but what led, was it bad product they purchased, or was it job loss? Did you kind of cover that, or can you just kind of real...
Sure. Unfortunately, the data I have at my disposal don't give me any clear indications yet as to why a foreclosure happened. Simply just that a foreclosure has happened and the household characteristics of the household that experienced it. So I have my own ideas about that, but it's not based on this particular study. I mean, what we know about foreclosures are that typically there's a trigger involved. There's a loss of a job, unexpected health care expenses. There can be a variety of instances that can lead to a foreclosure. But the actual foreclosure process usually occurs when it's more effective for the person to, when they can't afford the mortgage anymore, right? So when all other avenues available to pay the mortgage are gone. Now, to what extent these actual foreclosures represent predatory loans is unclear at this point. My suspicion is that a very high proportion of them are. That's borne out by other research, most recently Myra Norfield's research out of the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wanting to testify either for or against House File 626? Sir, please come on down. Sir, you've probably noticed the pattern. Please introduce yourself to the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm Al Flowers. I'm from Minneapolis, and I do a TV show on MTN to kind of get things out to the community. And I came over, I'm a little disturbed about, I don't know if I came here to hopefully back the group about keeping their houses. And I got this with the doctor foreclosures in Minneapolis, in North and South Minneapolis, which is being hard hit. And I don't know, I'm to the chair, I'm trying to figure out, I'm new at coming over to the legislature, so I'm used to dealing with Minneapolis, but I'm trying to figure out if this committee is going to support this group in this effort to stop, put a moratorium on these foreclosures. I'm not understanding if it's going...
Mr. Flowers, if you would move your hand, we can take a look at your map.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And
I said I didn't. I'm new at this.
But that was a highly technical.
That's quick too. That's good.
Just for members of the audience and members of the committee who served on this committee the last biennium, or on the Commerce Committee the last biennium, or on Civil Justice the last biennium, you saw, if not these maps. Oh, thank you. if not these maps, highly similar maps that I used in the work that I did in moving forward the foreclosure deferment bill, House File 3612, in the last biennium.
Okay, and I'll finish up here, but the reason I'm so concerned, because I know it's millions of dollars coming down in stimulus money to the state of Minnesota that could possibly help a lot of this situation, and for this body, the state representative and the Senate, to make sure that those resources that's coming down, that they said from the Obama administration, you have to spend it really quickly. And sometimes when you spend it really quickly, you miss the people that it should really help. So that's why I'm asking, so I can take back and would like a copy of this tape of this hearing today to see what's going on, so we can play it back in the community and say if it's being helpful to come over here. I think this group is that they put together, the unions, is very supportive of trying to stop people from losing their houses or putting a moratorium on, or just helping people that really need the help, and seeing that, you know, we all know about all the bailout and the millions of dollars going for bonuses for people that don't deserve it. These are people that deserve it, and I hope this committee, and I thank Representative Bly, who I just met today, but I thank him for bringing it forward, and I hope this committee really takes it seriously and helps the normal everyday people that need the help, and they need the help from you guys at the state house and the state senate. So that's my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. We are going to start losing members here, it looks like, now, if not soon. To Mr. Flowers, I would assure I would assure you this is not the only piece of legislation moving forward this year related to foreclosure. I believe this committee's first hearing was a special hearing to hear Representative Mahoney's bill that extended and expanded unemployment benefits in the current crisis, working with the federal government. There are other bills related to the foreclosure crisis. I have personally a bill related to renters and the foreclosure crisis, working on my the base of last year. In addition, this committee has heard a number of bills related to payday lending, related to other consumer protection issues in this economic time. Representative Mahoney.
And Mr. Chair and committee members and members in the audience, Section 9, a job creation grant program, Chair Lucavina put through a bill through workforce and higher ed last night, calling for $140 million in a job creation program. So many parts of this bill are moving forward separately, and hopefully we'll get most of those passed separately, if not this one.
Ms. Hakeem, were you wanting to testify as well? I just saw you up. Anyone else wishing to testify? Sir. And this will be the final testifier, so we don't lose everybody in the room for other committee hearings. As you've seen, sir, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Michael Kidd. I'm a resident of North Minneapolis. I'm just kind of trying to connect the face to some of these stories and these situations. I bought my home 4 years ago in North Minneapolis, put a $45,000 down payment down on a 6% 30-year fixed rate, basically did everything the right way. Due to a high foreclosure rate in North Minneapolis and also for the flipping scams that have taken place. The place, they did a market analysis, it's valued now at $85,000. I purchased it at $189,000. I'm a self-employed truck driver who's been unemployed for 3 months. It's in part due to the lack of employment, which has been brought about, you know, due to the economy, but it's also, I'm underwater. I mean, even if I were working, it makes little sense to try to salvage something that I owe $142,000 on that's appraised at $85,000. So that kind of just sheds a light on what's going on, and I just hope, you know, that some of this money gets to the people who really need it. So
thank you, Mr. Kidd.
I appreciate it.
So does this committee.
Thank you.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Daphne, and members, and thank you, Representative Mahoney, for pointing out the bill that Representative Rukavina passed on. I know that this particular bill does have some things that we need to work on, and I'm hoping that we can fix all of the things that need to be fixed and take care of the people in a way that will really help them. So, and I understand that we're going to lay the bill over, is that correct?
Representative Bly, what I would recommend is to give you time to continue to work on the bill, that we lay the bill over at this time.
Yeah, and that's my intent.
All right. Thank you. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned. Thank you all for being here today.